So my name is Marcia White, and I am a survivor of domestic violence. I was married to Leland Errol Bass, Jr. from April 1st, 1978 until January 16th, 1983, on the day I shot and killed him.
After years of enduring abuse and living in terror, Marcia White finalized her divorce from her ex-husband, Leland Bass, Jr. 2 days later, he kicked in the door of her Eastside home and held her at gunpoint. In self-defense, she shot and killed him. The Columbus Dispatch is telling the stories of several people who took someone's life. I'm Dispatch reporter Erica Thompson, and in this podcast episode, you will hear White recount her experience in her own words. She shares the tragic series of events that led up to the day she took her husband's life and how that experience motivated her to help other survivors of domestic abuse. To support journalism like this, subscribe to the Columbus Dispatch at dispatch.com/subscribe. Please be advised, this episode contains descriptions of violence.
The beginning of the relationship was so awesome. He was a wonderful, brilliant, gentle man. He was the only child, so he was used to being alone, spending a lot of time by himself. But he was a really nice guy. But what I was most attracted to was his brilliance. He was very, very smart. And I think that was because his mother was an educator. And his father was a politician. His father worked for, at that time, Mayor Tom Moody for the city of Columbus. So we both came from pretty stable households. So it's amazing, because of how the marriage ended, that it wasn't a physical throughout the whole relationship. A lot of it was intimidation and fear. I can't remember maybe twice that we actually fought, and it really wasn't even a fight. It was me trying to get out and to leave, and he pulled me back and slammed me into a wall that had a speaker on it that gashed my face. But it really wasn't a fight. And let me go back to and say that on my 21st birthday, he gave me a gun. He gave me a 38 special as a birthday present. And it would actually be the gun that I shot and killed him with that he had given me for my birthday 5 years before. I always knew that he smoked weed, smoked marijuana, always knew that, but did not know of his involvement with heroin and cocaine for years later. And because his behavior got so bizarre and confusing, like I never had been around anyone that behaved the way he was behaving. And it was complete opposite to the man that I knew. Actually, I would find cooked spoons that had burns on them out in my yard and couldn't figure out, like, who's doing this? Why is somebody throwing our spoons away? Then one of my cousins came, my older cousin, and told me when he saw it, he's like, he must be cooking dope. And so then I started thinking, I really need to get out of this relationship. And I started leaving. And every time I would find a safe place to go, either with a family member or a friend, he would find us, and either he would kidnap my children, which would make me have to go back, or he would physically drag me out of the house and make me come back. So I wasn't afraid of him at that time. It wasn't until a couple of years later that I really became afraid of him, of what he would do. I started to believe him when he would say, I'm never going to let you go. I will see you dead before I see you leave and take my children. And, you know, he started saying, I was like, that, you know, I'm all arrogant. No, you're not. You're not going to do anything to me. But further into the marriage, I began to believe that his intent is to kill us. So I missed a whole part that was this very important when I filed for a divorce before I left our home on the west side. And he kicked in the door, shot up the house. He shot up every room, pulled the refrigerator from the kitchen to the dining room and threw all the food up against the walls. And held me at gunpoint, raped me that night, and said, "I'm not going to let you divorce me." He had been served with divorce papers that day that he did all of that. And he went to sleep. And when he went to sleep, I rolled over out of the bed and got his gun and crawled down our hallway, looked in the bedroom, told my oldest daughter to get dressed. By then, we could communicate without talking. And I was motioning to her to get dressed and get CJ and Lisette dressed. And she just shook her head, yes. And I was like, "It's going to be okay." And I crawled down the steps and got my bullets. So I already had my gun with me. But when he came up the steps from kicking in the door, I put my gun on the table beside the bed because I didn't want him to think that I was going to be confrontational with him. And so he went to sleep. When I went downstairs and got bullets and loaded my gun back up and his gun back up, climbed up on the bed, was holding the gun to the back of his head because I was like, "This will not happen again." And my daughter, my oldest daughter, walked into the bedroom and she said, "Shooting, Mommy, shooting." And I looked over at her and my heart just broke. Like, I don't want that to be burned into her brain to see that. So I climbed off of the bed, got her and her brother. He sort of turned over, looked at me, and went back to sleep. Took my children up on Sullivan Avenue at Whitethorn or Midland, where there's a Dairy Queen, set them on a bench, called my friend. We didn't have cell phones back then, so I had to go to a payphone and ask her to come and get my children, that I was going back and I was going to kill him. He would not do this to me again. And she began to beg me not to go back. Like, "You're away, you're out, don't go back, please don't do that. You're starting to sound like him. If you go back, you're going to jail. That's premeditated murder if you go back and do anything to him." And so I'm looking at my children and she's like, "Think about what will happen to your kids if you go back to that house." And so she convinced me to wait for her. So she came and picked us up and we went to her house to live. At the end of the summer, I went back to our home because we needed winter clothes. And when I went back in, it looked like a horror movie. Like, there were maggots crawling all on the walls from the food that had been thrown on the walls. He took a hatchet and chopped up all of my grandparents' furniture that they had given to me. All the washer, dryer, stove, everything had bullet holes in it, bullet holes all in the ceiling. The banister going upstairs had been chopped down, like it was, the whole stairs were collapsing. And I was afraid to go in, and my aunt was with me, and my sister was with me. My aunt took pictures because it was so unbelievable. And I was like, "I can't." She said, "You have to go and get your kids' clothes." So went upstairs and got enough winter clothes for all of us. And that would be the last time I ever saw that house. I was like, "I'm never coming back here again." That's when we really were on the run, like, from him. So from Christmas, he came bringing gifts. And January 15th, he came back to my home, held me at gunpoint, threatened to kill us. And when he left, and I had my gun laying on the counter. I never was without it. I slept with it under my pillow. It was always within reach. But he had access to my children because they were outside playing in the snow. And he's standing in the doorway and he's like, "Go ahead and go for it." And I just kept washing dishes. But I had hot water on the stove. I was trying to make the kids some hot chocolate. And I was thinking, like, can I get to the hot chocolate and throw it on him? And I was like, I can't do anything to take a chance that he will do something to my children. And so whatever he told me to do, I agreed to do it. And then he left, got the kids back in the house. And I told them, if he ever comes back again, one of us is going to die. And my youngest daughter, she said, "I know it's going to be my dad." And I started crying. And I was like, "No, it's not. No, it's not." I know she loved her father. But then I had to remind myself if it wasn't, that it would be us. And the next day he did come back. He kicked in my door at 10 something in the morning and was hollering up the steps, like, get your black ass down here. Don't make me come up there. If I come up there, I'm killing everybody. And so I walked down the steps, still had my gun, oops, in my back pocket. And he hit me across my head and I fell. And I got to back up because he had told me if I ever felt so afraid that I needed to pull my gun, that I better be prepared to pull the trigger. And so that morning, when I pulled the gun out, I fired it 3 times and shot him in our living room while our children were upstairs listening. I went over to him and was saying to him, I forgive you. I knew he was dying because I could tell the way his breathing was. And I was asking him to ask God to forgive him for everything that he had done, like, just ask God to forgive you. And I heard the rattling of his breathing and it stopped. And I knew he was dead, but it didn't register he was dead. And I had a friend that was there. And he came downstairs and he said, you did what you had to do. And I didn't have a phone, so he said, I've got to go and call the police. And I panicked then, like, you got to call the police on me? Like, that, I don't know what I thought was supposed to happen after that. Like, it was just done. And he said, and it was a fireman that lived across the street from where we lived. He said, I said, please call my brothers first so they can come and get my kids. Call my brother. And I was thinking I'm going to prison. So I was never arrested. I was never charged. I was never hailed. They let me go. They was like, well, your whole family is out there waiting on you.
White was able to escape legal punishment because no charges were filed in Bass's death. But unable to live with the shame of what she'd done, she spiraled into drug and alcohol addiction and entered into other abusive relationships. After renewing her relationship with God, she turned her life around and began helping other survivors of domestic violence. She currently works for Impact Community Action, a local nonprofit tackling poverty, where she developed a curriculum to teach about healthy relationships. The horror that she endured in the past has given her a purpose today.
What good came out of it is a platform that it gives me to talk about grace and mercy, forgiveness, acceptance, and a basic human right as a human being, as a woman, to live free from the threat of violence in your home. You have that as a basic human right. Nobody's doing you a favor that you're allowed to live in peace.
To read more about Marcia White and the stories of others in our series, visit dispatch.com/I took a life. And if you or someone you know is in danger, you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline at 1-800-799-7233.